This is IT Visionaries, your number one source for actionable insights and exclusive interviews with CIOs, CTOs, and CISOs, and many more. I'm your host, Albert Chow, a former CIO, former sales VP, and now podcast host. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of IT Visionaries, and today I have a special guest. His name is Bill Wade, and he works at one of probably the most known companies in the world. In fact, or maybe it's the most unknown. I have no idea. But let me tell you a little something about this. They have a product that produces a number that we all use consistently. If you have a credit card, your FICO score matters. It's from a company called the Fair Isaac Corporations. It's NYSE traded FICO. They do well over a billion dollars a year revenue. And I don't think anybody knows, Bill, that there's a company behind my FICO score. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Albert. Appreciate it.
Hey, listen, I'm hyped up because when I saw this hit my desk, I was like, what is this? I don't even know what this is. And I look you up. You're the chief product and technology officer of FICO. And I'm like, oh, I know what FICO scores are, but what is this company? And I was like, oh, the FICO score is actually produced by a company. Bill, for those who are unaware, which I was, let's start there. What is the FICO company? And of course, the question everyone's going to want to know is, do you do anything else besides produce that credit score?
Great question. Question we commonly get asked. The FICO credit score is the brand, but behind that sits, as you said, FICO, the company. FICO's actually been in business since 1956. So we've been around for a very long time. All of the early history was around using analytics to make better predictions. We started... Bill Fair and Isaac actually started the company predicting places to go drill oil wells. Mm. And out of that came an interest in building a repeatable, simplified way of actually identifying credit risk. And the inception of that led to the FICO score. And there's a fair bit of math that goes into it and a long history of analysis of lots of data. And what most people think of as the FICO is the credit score. That is about half of the business at FICO. But there's another side to FICO as well. We have a software division within the company. And that software division is in the business of operationalizing analytics, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and decision, as well as optimization and simulation. And all of those get applied predominantly in financial services, but also outside of financial services in a variety of use cases to drive business decisions.
You mentioned it's been around since 56, and you yourself have been part of FICO for over 20 years. Now, you also mentioned something kind of pretty cool before we got started recording is that your company and you and your team have been exploring artificial intelligence, machine learning for quite some time. How do you and your team, how are you looking to apply it? And what are you looking to accomplish with it?
Artificial intelligence and the wave that's around it is actually quite good for us. we're happy to see the level of interest in actually applying machine learning and artificial intelligence. We've been doing this effectively since the late 80s, using neural net technology specifically to identify abnormal behavior patterns, fraud being the first use case, but several other use cases as well. And the use of that technology is applied. And this is an important aspect of it, which is you can take a machine and actually have it run the math. But to take a machine and have it make a decision for you involves a whole lot more than just the machine crunching a bunch of data. And so we've been doing this in what we call operationalizing the analytics, which means making it part of a business operation, giving business control and understanding of what that machine's doing, a clarity around what it can expect from that machine, and then how to use the output from that machine to drive business decisions, such as my little fraud example that I gave you.
I'm familiar with how Carfax operates. Carfax, for to kind of set the stage for anyone who's ever gotten a Carfax report or is not familiar with the company. So Carfax, of course, has a consumer division, which produces the report that people want to see before they purchase a used car. But they also have other products for enterprises. You mentioned the FICO score is just half the business. And you kind of loosely mentioned like it's for other companies can assess risk, typically in financial services. But is there like a core product or is it like reporting and services all the time? Like do people log into FICO software? Like we have no idea.
Yeah. So this is actually often a very confusing topic, because what sits at the center of our software business is the ability to apply certain capabilities, such as AI and machine learning, but also decisioning, various forms of that, optimization and optimization strategies, and simulation. All of these are key elements that help a business make a better business decision. We do that both as a decision support, which might be at a decision point about what should I do with a portfolio, like where should I drill an oil well, or how should I lay out a wind farm. These are actually uses of FICO technology. The more common use of it, though, is in real-time decisions. So where you want to actually apply these capabilities to actually interact with some consumer and make some decision that affects that consumer or helps that consumer. And while we do business outside of financial services, the majority of it is in financial services. And we do a whole bunch of things in financial services, from acquiring through to customer management, where we assess line strategies, marketing offers. It might also be things like protecting you from fraud transactions or from payment transaction fraud, or it could actually be in protecting you from delinquency situations and helping you out of a tough spot. That part of our business is the lion's share of it. And it happens in the background, where banking institutions use that software to help operate their business. We actually are a core part of how the banks operate.
Yeah, I'm just starting to think about all the different scenarios, because I'm thinking from a consumer side, it's pretty simple. If I apply for a credit card, typically I can get an answer like within a split second. It'll tell me like if I'm approved that day. I remember there was a period of time when, I don't know, like when I got married and I had to fill out a plane. They remember when they had the on the plane that, well, they still do it. They want you to sign up for the credit card rewards. You'd mail it in. You might get a notification, weeks later that says, hey, you're getting a line of credit for $10,000 or whatever the number is. And nowadays, of course, if you fill out, you get the number right away. I understand a lot of this real-time processing happening right there. When we were doing research to have you join the show and I started reading about FICO, I couldn't believe how big the company actually was. I always knew, like many of our listeners, that there was a FICO score. I just never really thought there was a company behind the FICO score. And then when I found out how big the company was, then I was like, well, I wonder how defensible it is, because I'm assuming there are kids in their garage, because anything that's done well, typically we'll have a competitor. There's probably kids in the garage or engineers somewhere at some university who's like, why is the FICO score the way it is? Could it be improved? Could it be made better? And I'm sure that there are a lot of people working on it. Let's just assume that. But now I'm starting to understand a little bit, like, how's it been around since 19? Well, it's because you've built in all these other things that give it, like, it's more than a score. Like you just said, it's way more than a score. How do you try to stay innovative? Because do you feel like you are the leader? Like you cannot be touched? Or I don't know how big you feel like your moat is. Do you feel like you're constantly being challenged? Like, I wonder what the innovation cycle or the pressure to innovate is at a company like yourself.
Every tech company should be feeling competitive pressure and the interest to innovate. I think for us in the recent history, what we've seen particularly is that there's a move towards digital engagement and an increase in that. Anybody who's been around during COVID knows the importance of a digital engagement, right? So if you weren't digitally ready when COVID hit, you were in trouble. If you were digitally ready, you actually came out on top. There was a recent study done by Accenture that predicted that those companies that had better understanding of their data, that had a platform for automating their decisions, and actually applied machine learning and artificial intelligence successfully, were growing at twice the rate of any company that did not. During COVID, they actually measured those companies as growing five times. So what happened at the inception of COVID is if you weren't yet digitally ready, it became an imperative to you. You needed to be digitally ready. And so you needed to be able to take what you are as a bank, the core thing you do, the decisions you make, and the products you offer, the way you operate your business, and you need to be able to put it out at scale. Interestingly enough, there's a second dimension to this, which is not only was it digitally engaging with the consumer, inside the bank, you needed to engage digitally because you couldn't go into the office anymore.
That's right.
You couldn't make changes to your IT infrastructure because you couldn't get access to the environments in a safe and secure way. So those that were actually already working collaboratively together, the marketing department, the risk department, the line of business, all of these units working together collaboratively, they were finding ways to very quickly respond to the environment changes in COVID. And those who could, they capitalized. And so we've been focusing entirely on building that sort of collaboration environment whereby it's not just one decision that a bank makes, it's all of them. Because if you think about it, if you're a consumer, you don't want to be treated a certain way when you deal with your credit card versus when you deal with your checking account. Like, you're a consumer. The bank is the bank. They should treat you like the same. So they should know when you're dealing with a credit card interaction that you're also a banking customer with a checking account. And those two things should come together. If you can't do that today, then you're going to be left behind on this digital movement. This is where we actually see our growth and where we actually are growing, which is we bring that connectedness of the way that the business operates together across multiple stakeholders in a way that no one else does today.
I think most people have a credit card. I think that's the number one instrument that most people have. I think a lot of people have mortgages and auto loans, but I don't know. Maybe some people don't, but I think that's the most prevalent. What's interesting when you mention all these products is just how many other access points people need access to capital. One of the challenges I encountered and have encountered in the past is business lending, because your personal score is part of it, but it's not quite the factor. And you mentioned that oil and gas, wind farms, like, is it part of commercial lending as well? Like, understanding the industry? Like, so for example, you would use, I mean, I'm speaking for you, but I'd love to hear this. Like, my example would be like, hey, if I'm a restaurateur, I'm entering a highly volatile category. I don't know if you have data on that. Or if I'm like a big company, I think publicly traded companies that do rare things. Like, I think Six Flags and Cedar Fair just merged. They make amusement parks like that. When they need to go to the bank for money, that's a different business. Like, there's not really even examples of what outside of themselves. You know what I mean? Like, there's only a handful of amusement park companies in the world. Is that part of it? I'm curious.
It is. You got small business lending where you're right. There's a relationship between you as a consumer and your small business. And very often your business is reflective of the credit behavior that you have as a consumer, but not always, right? So you're right. There's other data that comes into it. And we actually have a score for that too. It's called the FBSS score. But but there's different decisioning that occurs, right? Because you're talking about a business now. So you got different liability issues. You've got, maybe you have storefront, maybe you don't have storefront. Maybe you're digital, maybe you're not. So there's lots of things that come together. And then you get into heavy duty commercial lending, where very complicated. We do all of that as well. What's interesting is the use of our platform isn't just for the lending aspect, which it is in this case, in your scenario. But it's also for non-lending activity, just servicing.
Okay.
Let's say, for example, you went to an ATM and you asked to withdraw $100 and you got 80. What do you do? Well, you got to get it resolved, right? So some of our companies have actually put digital assistance out there where you can go and lodge your complaint. How do you handle that complaint? Well, you can put people on it to go investigate it, or you could actually automate it. People have automated it with our platform. And it looks at various decisions and goes, you know what? You're right. We lost $20 for you. We're going to deposit that back in your account. Problem solved. You're a happy customer. Digital engagement. You got immediate resolution. You did it right on your phone right after you left the ATM. You got your $20 back. You're going to stay active with this bank because this bank is looking after you, and you, that digital engagement was up. So it goes beyond lending.
So this happened to me. For anyone who's ever done this with cash deposits, I'll say the bank, it's fine. I use Bank of America. I put in a certain number of cash and I was just like, you know how you're maybe fast to click done? Yes, 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 done, confirm, confirm. But I did that. I was like, wait a second. I think short. The computer was short and I didn't know how to fix it. And they had a little number. And I remember logging a call. I was shockingly surprised how quickly it got resolved, because I thought that the only way that they could fix it was to go open the till and see how much extra cash was in there or not in there. And could they attribute it to my deposit? I have no idea. I was legit nervous. It's like, wait a second. I think I might just be out.
It's amazing how much data actually does get collected, even at the device that you just mentioned, the POS, the device.
Yeah.
All of that information is actually streamed somewhere. You tap into it and all of a sudden you can actually resolve a whole bunch of issues. So it goes beyond the lending, and actually outside of banking, we do a fair bit of of stuff that you would not expect from a decisioning engine. I mentioned about the wind farms. That's an example of what we use. We also do energy balancing. So if energy distribution, there's peaks and demands, and you need to figure out how to get to the energy. You need to anticipate what energy you need to produce and when to turn the power generation up and when to turn it down. As another example, things like how much fuel you're going to need, or fuel routing, or crew scheduling for airlines. These are the types of things that get automated on our platform.
Do customers know that they can call you? This whole conversation is throwing me off a little bit, because this is a massive company. Like, this is not like some startup that, you know, some people know about, some people don't. Like, this is a company, like you've said, that's been around for decades, that produces a product or a service that we pretty much, I think, all consumers use in some way. Anyone over 21 has used, or had someone else use it for them. And I was like, I didn't even know this company exists. So then I was thinking, like, as you were saying, it can do all these different things. I'm like, do they know? Do other people know that you do these things?
In almost all cases of our business, we actually go through a banking organization or a partner channel.
As a CTO and product officer, you're also thinking about the future. What do you anticipate happening, or what are you trying to accomplish or hope to accomplish in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. I think just a little bit of history here might help for context to answer that question. I actually started my career in AI back in the late 80s as well, doing work for National Science Foundation. And I found the technology extremely powerful, but also unapproachable. It was very difficult to use. So a couple things have changed. First, compute, memory, data, that has magnified by many, 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 many times. So that changes the game for anybody who wants to look at machine learning and AI, which is part of the reason for the population growth. But the other part of this is it needs to be usable. If this remains black box magic and the business doesn't have transparency to what it's actually doing, how it actually gets applied, and what that impact to their business is going to be, it will not get used. I don't care how good the model is. And you can look at a bunch of reports like IDC, like they say 85% or more of analytics never see the light of day. Why? It's not because the analytic is bad. This isn't because the data scientists didn't do a good job. They didn't actually put it into the business context in a way that the business says, oh, I can use that. I know what it's going to do to my business, and I'm comfortable with that. So the future and everything that we are focused on is actually to make this machine learning and AI, put it into the hands of the business as explainable, transparent, and the ability to improve it in a collaborative way. So as the data scientist is working on it, it's not a black box anymore. Now, all of a sudden, what they're working on, we have direct traceability between their data and their model and what business decisions are made and how effective they are. So when they want to introduce something new, we can very quickly tell you if it's going to add value or not add value. The more you bring the business into controlling that, and the faster they can move, the faster the business is going to be able to grow, the more they use of us. And that's our primary area of focus. And there's many ways that we are looking to do that and are doing that, but that's our primary thrust.
There's a huge movement of low code, no code, of course, now with prompt engineering is the new term. It's going to soon be like, you're not even going to type it. You're probably text the prompt that's already here. I don't know. Are those like elements of simplification or usability that you're talking about? Because there's a wave of thought where it suggests that if you have only developers developing, it limits the amount of creative solutions that are out there.
Yeah.
But if other people could leverage the data and the platform in a way that they understand, so like language, drag and drop models, whatever, it becomes more powerful. Is that what you're talking about, and making it more accessible in that regard?
So it's an interesting question. It actually would probably open up a technical debate with some of my colleagues in the industry here. But I think the first thing that I would say is that we don't even think of it as low code, no code. We actually think of it as actually business enablement. So everything that we do is visual. Everything we do is actually instruction-based. It's business-oriented, so that when you can look at large volumes of data and you can see a very complex decision in the form of summary outputs and KPIs, then it becomes usable. So there is no code in our
gotcha.
And we aren't looking for it. The low code, no code, actually, just as a small point of interest, is low code, no code still becomes code. And yeah. You still got to manage this code. We've circumvented that problem. We've gone well past the idea of code. We've actually done this as a set of assets that become composable. And the business can compose whatever they want. Now, they can be our assets or they can be somebody else's assets. We're agnostic to that. But if you pull it into this composability environment, then the business can do whatever they want as long as you expose it through that composable interface. And one of the ways that actually this enhancement becomes real is understanding the complexity of that. And one way to understand the complexity of that is something like what you see in generative AI. Not to actually generate something as much as it is to use that very natural interface to ask it questions mm-hmm. or to drive you to an outcome or in a direction that you need to go look at. And this is the power of the machine, because you have all that data, you have all that understanding. Let the machine come back to you and make some suggestions on where you go look. But the human ultimately makes the decision in our world, right? The human yeah. still is in charge and makes the outcome. The machine is there to help the human.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that superpower that you just talked about is like also fractional improvement. I'm assuming this happens a lot with your product, where someone comes up with a model and maybe they've got what they think, but they want to introduce a new variable or they want to refine it just a little bit more. They don't want to retype everything. They want to be able to easily test and see a result. So for sure, what you're talking about would make that process loop much, much faster to see like, okay, incremental results very quickly will lead you to the best outcome possible in the shortest period of time.
It's funny you bring that up, Albert, as one of our biggest use cases examples. One is changes of strategy, but the other one is okay. I had a new piece of data. Does it help? That is the most common thing that we get asked. And so the business can actually introduce that data, make that assessment on their own without any IT or any programming or any assessment whatsoever. And then if you decide to use it, we go one step further. We actually track that over time and we can tell you, oh, yeah, that new piece of data is now being used 30% of the time or 0.3% of the time. And this is the outcome that you got from that new piece of data. That sort of level of business insight, that's what you really need to give to the business to empower them to do the investigation of, hey, can I make it better? And wait a minute, is it actually better? Or am I just playing with data here?
I've been in the world of marketing for a long time. What you just described here is like, would have saved me, I don't know how many scenarios of people asking. So like a good example is social publishing. So social publishing, the idea of, you know, producing content on Facebook, Instagram, whatever, right? People always ask these questions about like, how would it impact performance if you did just name whatever and it's greenfield, you know? And then a lot of times, like, does it impact the bottom line? Because that's the ultimately what they really want to know. If you could help me get to that answer faster, that would be, and I think about all these like long tests that we did that yielded almost no result and how painful
that
was.
Imagine if you could do that and 2 hours later you had your answer. Yeah, but it wasn't just one scenario. It was hundreds of scenarios.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. That is awesome. Bill, man, it has been awesome having you on the show. I did not, like I said, I was excited to do this episode because I knew the platform, based on revenue numbers alone, was substantially more than the score. And it is cool to hear you talk about it. I want to ask you some questions about yourself. How did you end up at FICO? I mean, let's start there.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, back to my earlier point about doing work with AI and machine learning back in the 80s, it sort of set and cement my career and my journey. I wanted to make it easier to use, drive better business outcomes. And it sort of meandered from there to implementations. I had the unique opportunity to work at some interesting companies, Ford, Cessna, Ontario Hydro. In a period of 5 years, I've worked on hundreds of projects and just got a lot of experience. And then an opportunity came along where there was some older technology in the AI space that we had the opportunity to make it modern. And we did so, and it worked extremely well. And through an acquisition, I ended up at FICO, where that acquisition wasn't the primary target. There was another target for the acquisition. And then I just took that forward and made it into a business and grew it quite large. And eventually one thing led to another. And today we have our FICO platform, which is the culmination of a lot of that technology that I've been working on for years, manifested as true business value for our customers.
There you go. One of the things our audience always wants to know is like, what are you like outside of work? I mentioned you have skis on your LinkedIn profile. Are you a big outdoors person? I'm assuming the answer is yes. How do you go about, you know, what do you do for fun, I guess, when you aren't solving these giant engineering problems?
Well, I'm blessed with five children and a wonderful wife, and they actually consume a very large portion of my happy time. But they're also very active kids. So we golf, we ski. There's a lot of travel involved. They all like warm weather and beaches. So that's definitely a fair bit of our time spent doing that. Water sports, et cetera. So there's a plethora of things to keep me busy.
There you go. What is the age range of your children?
I'm going to give away my age here now, Albert. I have one that's actually in high school yet. And then the four others are all through college and they're out in the working force.
Hey, listen. It's all good. My oldest son is 16. My youngest kid is 9, but my oldest is into engineering. And well, we saw that you're from Lehigh. Lehigh is like one of these, like also like these hidden gems. Talk a little about Lehigh. Like, do you go back often? Are you fond of it? Is it, you know, because now my son will be listening. Like, was Lehigh good? Because he's.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I owe a lot to Lehigh and my education there, and more specifically to the late Dr. John Wilson. Dr. John Wilson is the one who set me on my career on AI and machine learning. I was actually a civil engineering student, and I had the opportunity to work on a very unique project, which is fascinating. Dr. Fisher was the world-renowned expert on bridge fatigue for steel girdered bridges.
Okay.
So a little bit of trivia here. Steel bridges, they have the girders that run across to carry the weight. And on top of that comes the concrete deck. When these big trucks go pounding over them with their weight, the steel flexes. That's the way it carries the weight. But after millions of times of getting pounded like that, there's something called stress hardening. If you ever taken a paper clip and you just bend it like this so many times, mm-hmm. and it snaps.
It fatigues and snaps.
Right. So what happens is these girders start creating cracks. So Dr. Fisher was the expert in knowing where to look for the cracks. Are they a dangerous crack? And how do you fix the crack before the bridge falls down? So back in the 80s, we took what Dr. Fisher knew, put it into a machine, and then turned that around and handed it out to all the bridge inspectors in the United States for them to go look for cracks and fix them as if Dr. Fisher was there advising them every step of the way. And that was my introduction to AI. And you can see the power of that, right? It's like, that's saving lives by...
That's a life-saving project. That is cool. And I know that is a great application. You know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about. And you got to be part of that project?
I did. I actually wrote a million lines of code while I was there.
That is really cool. Listen, Bill, it's been awesome having you on the show, man. I feel like I've learned a ton from you, you know, obviously behind the company, but also some of the things that you guys are working on. I appreciate you taking the time to answer questions from me that, you know, maybe I sounded like uninformed, but I legit am. You know, I found out only about this when we booked the interview.
No, Albert, it was my pleasure. And actually, I enjoyed it very much myself.
There you go. Thanks for joining us today on IT Visionaries.
Thank you.